Hello and welcome to this podcast. Our mission is to inspire 1 million people and unleash their potential. I'm here today again with manager Rory, and today we're going to talk about normal versus natural and also how Rory got into health and fitness and becoming a coach and his background as well. So what are we talking about? Normal versus natural? We sort of talked about this last week.
Yeah, I think... Do you want to define what you consider normal, what you consider natural?
I think what we were talking about was what is normal for most people may not be natural.
Got ya. So sedentary lifestyles are normal,
yeah,
but they're not natural for human beings. We didn't evolve to sit around all day.
Exactly.
Cool. Well, that sort of ties in with my backstory as well, in that I first got interested in the world of, and we're going to come on to this later, aren't we? And we're going to talk about health and well-being and like emergency, acute kind of disease state stuff being picked up by the NHS in the UK. But then what happens when you're back on your feet? But you're just free of disease, but you're not necessarily optimally healthy. My kind of first foray into the health, well-being, fitness world, or not fitness, but say health and well-being, was thinking about how could I go back to the future on nutrition. So I first got interested in the paleo food movement. I'd started to get interested in CrossFit. I wasn't doing it, but I knew that a lot of CrossFitters on the west coast of America followed this paleo diet, this idea of eating like a caveman, eating like our ancestors, because we'd evolved to eat a certain way, and only in the last 100 years had we started eating lots of refined carbohydrates and processed foods,
and that's normal.
That's the whole normal versus natural again, isn't it?
Let's go. We're sort of probably a bit ahead of ourselves. I'm sure we'll come back round to this. But what was childhood like for you growing up? As like, were you into sports? Were you into fitness? Like, and then let's say before 10, if you can remember, that period of time, like what was, or maybe before you were a teenager, you know, what was that period of time like for you?
So pre 10. So that was before organised team sports. So I started playing football for a football team at, say, 9 or 10. But before then, I remember doing gymnastics as a kid. And I wish I'd have carried on. I wish my mum had made me keep going instead of doing football, because I'd certainly be more mobile and probably more dynamic today.
I used to do taekwondo, and I was always gutted that my parents let me give up. my brother became a black belt, and I didn't.
Nice. Nice. Yeah, it's funny. We don't know what we need, do we? Just as children and as adults sometimes. And horse riding. I grew up in the countryside. Oh. Learned to ride when I was about 3 years of age, I think. Again, another thing, perhaps not to the same extent in terms of day-to-day function as gymnastics, but it would have been a nice thing for me to maintain as well.
Okay.
And then I became obsessed with football at about 7. Went to see my first game playing at school, and then joined a team. Probably under 10s would have been my first proper 11-a-side season on a full-size pitch, which is now like way too young to start kids at 9 on a full-size football pitch, 11-a-side, and they don't really do that anymore, but back then that was the way it was. And then I was obsessed with football. I played rugby in my first year of secondary school for the school team, but then had a knee ligament injury, so stopped playing rugby because it was endangering a football career. Career sounds grand. It wasn't that grand. I played for a good level for club and school, and that was the priority.
Okay.
Played cricket as a teenager, played golf. And then that kind of took me through to going off to university, where I stopped playing sport and I stopped training and started drinking.
Yeah. So you were heavily into sports as a kid, and it kind of fell apart at university by the sounds of things, which we'll get into. Was there any kind of consideration towards health or anything like that? Or was it just you're just doing it for fun? It's just like what you do?
There was no thought about playing sport for my health. I think that I only started thinking about health, and I was thinking about health in a very narrow kind of vain way around body image with a little bit of like function, probably about the age of 16 or 17. I started going to the gym once or twice a week with a mate who was interested, but no, before then it was just playing sport for the love of sport, the challenge,
teamwork.
Yeah. I'm a, you know, I was captain of school football team and one of my club teams, and I always felt like I worked harder and got more out of myself when I had people to represent and carry with me than if I was playing just for myself. So I loved team environment.
What about fitness per se? Like, did you train for? Did you do any kind of strength and conditioning for those sports, or was it again? Was it just kind of like playing the sports was what you did?
Playing the sports, you know, probably PE 3 times a week at school, midweek football training, Saturday morning football training, Sunday afternoon game. Then I started playing when I played semi-pro for a little bit of football. I'd play Saturday and Sunday and then train 3 times, 4 times a week. So it was just within the football environment, no other strength and conditioning.
Do you think like the lack of strength and conditioning had anything to do with like the knee injury that you picked up?
I think that was just a bit of a freak rugby tackle, okay. In that I got tackled by 2 players. One went low, one went high, and they sort of twisted me. And so the twist around the knee caused the ligament injury. Yeah. I lacked strength. I probably didn't lack for conditioning because I was doing lots of running and like running 1500 metres for the school and stuff like that. But it's not the same as what I understand to be strength and conditioning today.
Yeah. So you, in your sort of childhood and your upbringing, would you say that you identified as a sports person, a fitness person?
Like, oh, definitely. I remember my friends when mates started getting girlfriends at like 13 or 14 at school, and they'd go into town on a Saturday and they'd just walk around the shops all day and like go to the cinema with their girlfriends. I couldn't think of anything worse. I thought it was so boring. I was like, right, I'm at football training and then I'm going to come home and probably go to my mate's house and play football computer games and then come home and watch the evening game with my dad. And it was just, I was just obsessed with sport. Absolutely obsessed. I thought of myself as like my first job, part-time job, was as a lifeguard at the local swimming pool. I was just an active kid. Mm-hmm. I didn't really think about it as health. It felt quite natural.
Yeah.
My mum, I now realise, was always, without talking about it, was always influencing how sort of healthy we were.
And then, so you get to university, what happens at uni?
Oh, sex, drugs and rock and roll. Just without the rock and roll.
Or sex.
The drugs. No, it was, yeah, it was a bit of an awakening. I was, I didn't have a rebellious early mid-teens. I always knuckled down at school. I was always playing sports at the weekends. I started going to the pub and like on Friday nights and things like that when I knew I wasn't going to make it as a footballer. But I was quite well behaved, and then I went to university 4 hours from home up in Manchester and got really into music and the kind of night social scene and stuff, and just, I suppose my rebellion came a bit late. It came late teens rather than early teens.
Okay. And it, you know, what was that point where, it sounds like the football was actually going somewhere, and then you said you had the point where you were like, you realised you're not going to be a professional footballer. Was that that moment, or how did that affect you?
Yeah, I think at 11 or 12, I remember, maybe even younger, I remember going down to Charlton Athletic in South London for like a trials day. And I remember when the scouts from, because I grew up in Essex, so then you'd have the pro teams coming out of London, like Arsenal, Chelsea, West Ham, Tottenham would like travel out to watch Essex Cup final, or played in a couple of times, things like that. They were scouting for players. And I remember that realisation at about 13, 14, that actually I wasn't at that level. But my dad had always instilled in me this idea, you know, you better do well at school, because the chances of making it are so slim. So I'd never seriously kind of held that candle, and it'd been my be or an end all. But yeah, I definitely dropped off interest then at 14 when I thought, well, this, I started getting more interested in the Friday night in the pub than the game on Saturday.
Yeah. Cool. So what effect, how did that, you know, that time at uni, how did that affect your health? And your sort of mindset towards work and health and training and exercise and...
Yeah, so I remember one of my a guy I lived with at the time, he was the first, because it wasn't cool. I was the end of that. Do you remember how like every body on the front of like Rolling Stone magazine or NME in the 90s, they looked really unhealthy? Like all the supermodels looked unhealthy, all the musicians... looked unhealthy. It was that like 90s lad culture where it wasn't cool to work out, it wasn't cool to be fit. It's not like today where like every 15-year-old wants a six pack. Like back then it was all like you want to be photographed hanging out of a nightclub at like 4 a.m. because that was the sort of cool thing. So up in Manchester, I remember I was at the end of that sort of scene. It's like it wasn't cool to train or to be fit. Like good blokes generally, you know this, if you're good at a sport, it generally carries cachet with men, like as you're growing up in social circles, doesn't it? But that wasn't, there was a bit of that at university, but not really. It was more like who could pull more birds than who was like a fitter. And so then what happened is I remember going to the doctor during my dissertation, so I'd have been 20, probably the most, I failed my second year of university and they didn't make me redo it. They allowed me to come back in the third year and make up the modules that I'd failed in the second year. And so now I had to do like a year and a half's university in 1 year. And I remember that being very, very stressful and going to the doctor and going, look, I've got these stomach, I don't know what language I would have used then because it was before I had the knowledge, but I've got these stomach problems. And I said, oh, like my mum had always said to me, I've got IBS. So I sort of knew of this idea of IBS and it was stomach related and it was stress, anxiety related. So I went into the doctor, explained what was going on, and he would just went, oh, well, you've got IBS then. And then sent me on my way. And I'd sort of worked out by this point that, you know, if I drank loads of booze, it generally didn't make for a very good day the next day in terms of my stomach and digestion and bowels and everything else. I love bread, but I'd sort of realised that I couldn't eat too much bread.
Love bread.
should do a podcast just on bread.
We should go and do that from the bakery.
Yeah, we should. And so I started to kind of go, all right, well, you know, my mum can't really eat this and my mum can't really eat bread and I can't really eat bread and I shouldn't really drink as much as I do. And it's probably, you know, I've got this IBS thing. I don't really know what it is. There's nothing the doctors can do. And that was it really at university. That was kind of as far as it went with health.
Okay. And so what just kind of, because we'll probably kind of come back to this later, but what did the doctor prescribe you? What did, you know, how did that process go? Well, and maybe before you went to the doctor, how were you feeling?
I just remember being very stressed and anxious at the time. I'd had, and in terms of taking own, in terms of WITFIT merits and values, like if I'm going to be completely honest and take ownership and show integrity here. I was also using the IBS to get an extension of things at university. So maybe I was inflating the symptoms even so that I could get the doctor's note, so I could go back to university and say, oh, look, there's a medical reason here for you to give me an extension for a week or two or whatever I could get. So there was part of that. But yeah, at the time, I don't think now I was particularly worried about the digestive symptoms, but obviously clearly at the time, to go to the trouble at 20 of getting a GP appointment, where generally at that age you just sort of get through anything unless it's bad. It must have been quite bad. The symptoms must have been quite bad, yeah.
And what was the prescription that the doctor gave you?
The prescription was nil. The prescription was, well, you know, it sounds like you've got IBS. There's nothing we can do for you. It sounds like you sort of know what you shouldn't do, i.e. eat bread and get drunk. So why don't you just go away? Don't eat bread. Don't get drunk.
How did that work out?
It went really well, yeah. It was only another 10 years before I did something about it.
Okay, fair. And how does it impact you? Or how did it impact you in that period where you didn't really know how to deal with it, the IBS?
I suppose I would have made some changes to my behaviour, or I just mitigated the worst of it the next. So I would, for example, if I knew I was going out until late, I would schedule nothing for the next day. So like I would write off the next day because I knew the symptoms would be so bad that I couldn't play sport, or I probably would perform really poorly at work, so let's just write off the next day. And so I just lost days, I suppose. I sacrificed time. I quickly became aware, you know, a lot of young guys, well, probably and girls as well, but I know this more from a male perspective, use kind of sport to like get rid of their hangover. There's this idea that you play football or rugby the next day, or down here you get in the sea and you get, you know, the cold water on your head and everything to clear your hangover, isn't there? So like I quickly realized that I was absolutely awful at football with a hangover, that didn't work for me at all. It completely wrote me off. The performance was nil. There was no running it off or oxygenating myself to the point where I got rid of my hangover. It was just truly dreadful. Like spatial awareness, proprioception, everything was terrible. So how did it affect me? I think in reality probably the mental effects were greater than the physical over time as it compounded.
So what were those kind of mental effects? How did they accumulate?
I think it probably came to fruition at the end of my first career in commodities, really, at 30, where I came out of there. So you've got sort of 10 years of not really managing this and just thinking, oh, I've got IBS, there's nothing I can do about it, there's no medication, it's in my family,
it's a genetic,
it's just a thing that I live with, it's not that serious, I don't really need to do anything about it. And then that got through to 30, and I realized after leaving my job and taking a career break and then not going back to that industry, that actually I was very depressed, and that my physical state in terms of my fitness, because I was smoking at the time, drunk heavily, you know, my start to my day was black coffee and a cigarette, and then lots of coffee and cigarettes afterwards for the rest of the morning. Kick the cigarettes, no, struggling with the coffee. but then I started wanting to get fit, and then really wanting to understand my nutrition and my digestion and IBS, and so that then led to getting proper investigation via the NHS and then being diagnosed with inflammatory bowel disease. Maybe it always was IBS and it became inflammatory bowel disease. Maybe if I'd have got checked out sooner, it would have always been an inflammatory bowel disease.
Explain the difference.
So IBS is irritable bowel syndrome. So a syndrome is a fancy word that the medical profession use for we don't know what this is. So it's not a disease that we can diagnose, and it's not something we can give you medicine for, but there's a load of people out there like you who have similar symptoms, so let's call it a syndrome and put you in that bucket. Mm. And then inflammatory bowel disease is either Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, which are diagnosed diseases which can be medicated. Or the version that I've got, which is a little bit of Crohn's and a little bit of ulcerative colitis, but not so serious that I clearly have one or the other, or that I need medication.
So it kind of comes back to the thing we were talking about before we started the podcast here, which is doctors are very good at medicating issues and getting you back to a point where you're not showing symptoms necessarily, but you're not well. And so it sounds like you were not well and you had a few symptoms, but you weren't fully dysfunctional yet. And so no. The doctor wasn't really interested in dealing with what you had because it wasn't bad enough, basically.
No, that's right.
And then it took 10 years for it to get bad enough for you to then go, what the hell's going on?
Yeah, I wasn't well, but I wasn't in a state of dis-ease. I didn't have a disease.
No, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. I sat in that middle ground where I think the vast majority of the British population sit, unfortunately, which is you're not diseased.
And that's what we're kind of coming back to, is like that's what's normal for most people.
Yes.
Is you're not, you don't have a disease, but you're not well.
Yeah. So when you go to your GP surgery and you see the surgery or the clinic nurse and you get your blood test done, and they're going to test for, say, we're going into winter, so we're all in the northern hemisphere, we're probably gonna, unless we supplement, we're probably gonna come out in February next year with vitamin D that is suboptimal or even to the point of insufficiency. So if you go, or anemia is another thing, a lot of people are anemic from whichever cause, so you go and get your blood test for your iron or your vitamin D, don't you, and then it comes back and it's in a range. You'll have all seen this. You get if your GP gives you your results, they go, oh, you're normal. And normal means you just sit in a range where you don't have a disease. Yeah. That's all it means. It doesn't mean optimally healthy. It means you're not so low you've got a disease and you're not so high you've got a disease. And that's normal. And normal then is so wide, it's not optimally healthy.
Yeah. And I think, and we kind of look... That's a really interesting kind of point that I hadn't realised, but even if you're normal on all of those things, you could still not feel well.
Yep.
Because you may not be sleeping, you may not be moving, you may have terrible like ways of thinking about things, which is your mindset, you know, all of those big five things that we talk about. It's quite interesting, isn't it? We definitely are not slating doctors. And medicine is advanced now. Like we can diagnose and we can treat things much better than we used to, but we're not getting people to well. We're still only getting them to not sick.
Yes. And like, it's not the fault of doctors, mainstream medicine, the NHS, whatever else. Like, they're amazing at what they do well. And what they do well is treat acute accident and illness, and they're absolutely amazing at that. They will save your life in an emergency, they will fix your broken leg, and they will do the best they can, if it's curable, to cure you of that disease or manage your symptoms as well as can be possibly done if you have a disease. And that's what they're there to do. That's what the NHS was designed to do, except in the intervening 70 years our society has gone from undernourished looking like a very skinny person to undernourished looking like an incredibly overweight person, and now we have all of these diseases of obesity and lifestyle, and the NHS and your GP just aren't set up to deal with that.
Yeah. And I think there is an appetite from medical, like people who become doctors, they care about people, they want to help people, obviously. Most of them, I assume.
Yeah. Apart from Shipman.
And they clearly want to help people, and there's an appetite to get people well, but they just don't have the capacity.
No.
There's just not enough doctors to do that, and we hold doctors in such high regard, but still can come out of a full medical screen and still feel not well.
Yeah. Well, if you think about how much of health, you know, one of our big five is mindset. One of the five pillars of Whitfit is mindset. How much of that is just bedside manner, placebo, being a sounding board for people's problems before you even work on anything specifically? It's just giving people time and your attention so you can really hear how they feel. Really, it's for them to understand how they really feel, because often they don't until they express it to somebody else. And you spend I think in the UK you get 7 minutes with your GP.
yeah, and if you're private you get 15.
Yeah. So versus us kind of having an hour long conversation with somebody in the office
and seeing them three times a week.
Yeah.
And the all online education, like, we can have a huge impact, you know, on people's lives, and we are. It's great. So let's go back to your story. So you've been diagnosed now with inflammatory bowel disease, got it right, and what now?
Yes, well, it sort of coincided with, so three things came together. I'd left my job in commodities. I knew I didn't want to go back into that industry, into the city, into trading. I'd lived overseas doing that for half my 20s as well. I wanted to stay in the UK. I didn't want to be in the City of London. I didn't want to be in financial services or trading or anything like that. So there's one thing, is I've now left that career and I'm looking for who I really am and therefore what I'm going to do next. So there's an identity crisis piece. Then number two, there's the physical diagnosis, inflammatory bowel disease. Right, how am I? I was like, I'm not getting medicated. I'm going to fix it. I'm going
to
solve
this. So you don't want to be medicated?
No. No, I'm not taking medication for this.
Why not? At that time, why did you not want that?
I don't like the idea of taking assistance for something that I don't need to. Like, it was unnecessary. I knew that it would just treat the symptom, not the cause, and that the treatment of the cause lay with me as an individual and how I live my life. And I wanted to live my life differently. I wanted to practice like extreme personal responsibility.
And why did you get to that? How did you get to that point? Like, was it just because you were experiencing depression and things like that, and you just had had enough, or like, what was the?
I think when I left commodities, I think I sort of took off the armor of being like a guy who did this job that, and everybody thinks trading and broking is way more complicated than it really is. And so when you meet friends, family, or you meet new people in social situations, everyone's impressed with it, unnecessarily impressed with it, right? But they go, oh, it's like there's some sort of financial voodoo. Right. And it's not really. It's a lot of lads just who are way too angry and hungover, making something look more complicated than it really is. But it's... when it buys you the expensive watches and you stay in the best hotels and you go on amazing holidays, you fly around the world and you've got a million funny stories and all the rest of it, it was external meaning or identity. And then I took it away and I thought, fucking hell, what are you? And it exposed this sort of chasm that I felt inside, this lack of identity. And I think it was masked by the external identity. And then when I took that away, I was like, well, now I don't have internal or external. Like, who am I? What do I want to do with my life? And I knew I wanted to make a difference. I had 14 years of Catholic education, and what I took from that was, I'm incredibly lucky to be alive. Like, born in 1985 in the UK to in a comfortable family environment where I suffered no childhood trauma. I'm like the 0.1% of 0.1% of human beings who have ever lived. Right, if I just squander that opportunity by just pursuing, like, making money, then I'll die having not unleashed my potential. And so then there's all of that going on while thinking about what I'm going to do next, while going through therapy for depression, while then thinking about how do I live with this disease without having medication. So that was all happening in the same sort of 12 months.
So is this a period of time where you're kind of having these realizations, mini ones, or is it like one, there was one point, one book you read, or one person said something to you where you're like, fuck yeah.
I don't remember there being one particular point or book or person, but between basically turning 30 and turning 31, it all sort of happened in that year. Mm. And in terms of mindset, I'd never really read self-help stuff, positive psychology, anything like that. My first exposure to mindset was a guy came to my CrossFit gym. I'd got into CrossFit now by this point. And the guy came to the gym and he did mindset for functional athletes. He ended up being my mentor for about 4 years, and he's gone on and become very successful and now coaches like top CrossFit athletes in mental performance and things like that. But at the time it was just a Saturday afternoon in the CrossFit gym, and spent 2 or 3 hours there, and I thought, yeah, so I can use all of this stuff, this mindset stuff, for performance in the gym, great, but I'm not interested in being a pro CrossFitter or anything near that, but I could apply that to my life outside. Like, what am I going to do? I need to retrain. I want to start a business. And then, so the kind of my thinking then was, how do I apply what I'm learning about getting physically healthier and what I'm learning about being mentally healthier, and how do I put that together and create something for people like me? Because when I was unwell at 30, I was like, so I go to see a therapist and have CBT, and then I've got to try to kind of, I don't want medication, so the NHS can't really help me. I'm not thankfully that ill that I need surgery or anything like that, but like, who do I go and see? Do I go and see a nutritionist or whatever? And I thought, how does this all come together? How do you fix the mental, the physical, all in one? We're in one place, so people don't need a million different services.
Yeah. So what did you do?
So I went back to university and I studied nutritional therapy, and then as I was partway through that degree, my first 2 years I did a 4-year nutritional therapy degree, nutritional therapy and like health psychology, and the first 2 years I wanted to give back in some way, so I went to work in a special educational needs school and I helped them open a cafe and start some businesses to provide like lunches to the staff at the school and also to local businesses and things like that. So that was really, really cool. And then years 3 and 4 of the degree, I thought, let's train as a personal trainer. start going and working with the type of people who I once I'm qualified, I can do the whole shebang. And then I started studying mindset, taking courses, reading books, and sort of further training myself outside of the degree on the kind of psychological side of things. And then that all came together as I called what I did personal coaching, because it was sort of personal training, life coaching, nutrition, all combined. And I did that in London. I train people in the gym. I had a consultation room upstairs. We'd do nutritional consultations. We'd do mindset one-to-ones by Zoom and things like that. And then the pandemic, COVID-19, obviously, as you well know, Ben, closed all the gyms and everything else down. So now I was no longer going into a gym to personal train people. I wasn't seeing them to do nutritional therapy in a clinic. So then it all went online, and very, very quickly I moved away from doing Zoom personal training as part of it and just doing nutrition and mindset online, moved down here until I started working with you. That's what I was doing.
Cool. And what kind of attracted you to Whistling's Fitness then, and eventually obviously becoming manager there?
So when I first moved down here, I moved from, my training was as a CrossFitter at a CrossFit gym in London. So I moved down, my first thought was, let's search Chichester CrossFit or whatever. I saw various places in town, around the town, various different options. I thought, well, that's what I do, I'll go there. But quickly realized training at somewhere that offers CrossFit in the area, that it wasn't what I'd left behind in London, and that I needed, so there was no community, and I needed that more than ever. I was in a new area, I didn't know anybody, we'd gone through various lockdowns, so the opportunity to socialize and make friends was like nil. And I knew from when I first met you that we were kind of kindred spirits in that way, that we looked at things holistically. We thought about health first and fitness second, that we looked at the whole person and not just the state of their body or their performance on an air bike, but like, you know, were they mentally well? Did they live a healthy lifestyle, or did they just negate, you know, an unhealthy lifestyle by hammering themselves in the gym or whatever it was. And you know, we've joked about this before, but in a small village, reputations and things are kind of made and lost quite quickly, aren't they? Because it's a small community and people like to talk and things like that. So I had this idea of you. People had said to me, "Oh, you know, don't go to Whitfit, it's all like, you know, he's a bit of a head shrinker." It's like, he'll want to talk to you about mindset. But that made me want to come because I love all of that stuff. And I remember one of the first times we met you, probably you and I would have spoken much more about mindset than we ever did about training. And I think the community, the holistic nature of the gym, the kind of what you were doing around mindset. I think the fact that you didn't approach nutrition from a traditional kind of gym owner fitness way, like it wasn't about bodybuilding for the masses. It wasn't like taking bodybuilding ideas and giving them to the everyday person, which is what most personal trainers do. It was much more about health than performance. And when I say performance, I mean performance in a really narrow way.
Yeah.
Like for a sport, a race, or for what you look like in the mirror. And so I think for all of those reasons, it was like, this is the place for me.
Awesome. Right. Thanks very much. That was great. Full circle. We better leave it there because there's a massage about to happen, if I'm quite honest.
Not between us.
No. Thanks, Rory. If you enjoyed the podcast, don't forget to like and subscribe if that's what you do on a podcast these days. And please forward this to a friend who you think might benefit from it, or tag people, you know, with IBS who might like to hear Rory's story. Cheers.